This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. It's time for Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and speak to journalists and people in the know for their perspectives on the headline stories. Today, our guest is P. Gunasekaram, independent business analyst, of course, a regular on the show. Welcome again, Gunnar.
Thank you, Sharad.
Yeah, I want to begin with the shock departure of Malaysia Airlines CEO Peter Bellew. The question is, what was going on there?
Yeah. So just a little over a year ago since he took over, he resigned. He's going back to Ryanair as COO again. He claimed no interference. He claimed that staff were great. He claimed also that the shareholder, Khazanah National, and the chairman were great. So the inevitable conclusion is, was it just for more money and better prospects?
It would seem so, no. And actually, I was at a press briefing by Malaysia Airlines, soon after the plane purchases were announced, and reporters actually asked him whether he was going to Ryanair, he flatly denied it at that point of time.
But rumors were already in the air. People had already been talking about.
They'd already been talking about it, and Malaysia Airlines' statement. His resignation came to light through an announcement by Ryanair to the stock exchange, saying that Peter Bellew will join them with effect from December 1st. So, and then there was a statement by Malaysia Airlines expressing surprise at this development.
Yeah, Gunnar, so I'm very puzzled because now, obviously, Christoph Muller left a year earlier.
So-called personal reasons. And then he emerged in Emirates barely a few months later as their chief digital and innovation officer.
Correct.
So two people going in a space of maybe slightly over a year.
Yes. So is Malaysia Airlines like a stepping stone and better things? Is that what we've become?
It looks like it. But so then, the experiment with a foreign CEO seems to have been a major failure.
But you see, let's look at it from a different perspective than Gunnar. Now, not just I personally have of the view that getting a foreign CEO at the time where Malaysian Airlines was restructuring was probably the right thing because a lot of hard decisions needed to be made in terms of cutting personnel. You also had to have one of the criticisms previously of Malaysian Airlines was the amount of interference and pressures from external parties that a CEO had. Mm-hmm. So having a foreigner there was probably the right thing at the time.
Well, do foreigners come with special armor? Is that why they can withstand this? Are they not being paid by the same masters?
I think after what has happened to Malaysia Airlines, in other words, their huge losses, there was some amount of acceptance that maybe you need a foreign CEO because you can't find enough qualified people locally. And at least in principle, it was accepted there should be no interference for these people to run the airline according to a plan. Khazanah had already come out with a turnaround plan for the airline by then. So that was actually the rationale. But that would have worked if the foreign CEOs had stayed on for the 3-year contract. But after 1 year, how much could you have done? How much of training of local staff could you have done to hand over duties to them after the 3-year term? So here you have two quick departures, 1 year apart of the foreign CEOs. And then on top of that, a rather quick appointment has been made of Captain Izam as CEO designate, and he will take over from December 1st when Bellew officially leaves Malaysia Airlines. And it raises all kind of questions.
On the flip side of the equation, then let's just say that Christoph Muller had to chart and do all the dirty work. He literally cut costs, laid off all these people, the 6,000 people that had to leave. And then after that, cut costs further by cutting off unprofitable routes, then signing that alliance with, ironically, Emirates,
think about the conflict of interest that involves. After signing off this huge contract for co-chairing with Emirates, he joins Emirates as Chief Digital and Innovation Officer. Where was all these contractual things that you normally put into a CEO contract, such as you shouldn't join another airline for at least a year and so on?
And I absolutely agree with you on that, because a standard CEO contract, first of all, just the timing of the departure is really too short. It's almost as if he's like an executive. Because a normal CEO contract will have a 6 to 12 month either notice period or gardening leave period. So here is a situation where that's probably not been enforced, or if it was not in the contract originally, I think there's some serious issues with the board as to why that clause was not in the contract.
Yes, and then, all right, you made the mistake with Mueller. And then the same mistake is repeated with Bellew. You know? I mean, less than 2 months later, he's joining the Irish low-cost airline.
Guna, what do you think is going on? Is it a lack of foresight? Is it a lack of political will? Is Mas so desperate that they would have a contract without these safeguards? If you want to speculate here, what would you say is actually happening?
It's a bit strange for me that you don't have a proper secure contract with the CEO. You know, that should have been run right from the start. Perhaps it's the first time they are doing it. You know, the first time that a foreigner is getting into any major company, as far as I can recall, except for Proton, where you had a Japanese managing director in the early days.
But Guna, I think, you know, I would beg to differ on that. I think from a competency standpoint, I'm sure within the board and the search company, for example, who did the search to get Peter Bellew and Christoph Mueller on board, would have advised the board accordingly in terms of the contract.
So were the board badly advised? Is that what would happen?
I don't think so. A lot of times when a CEO exits an organization, there's an element of negotiation. So obviously they must have gone to the board and said, hey, look, looks like I need to leave.
So they asked for some exemptions in this case from their contractual obligations.
I would believe
perhaps.
So. But what is puzzling and worrying is also the fact that, you know, it's the issue of why does someone, a CEO, want to leave an organization so quickly? So it's two CEOs in succession. So, you know, if it was one person, you could probably write it off as an isolated incident. If it's two people in quick succession, you've got to have a lot of question marks in terms of, think of especially Peter Bellew's carefully worded statements. Khazana were always very supportive of me. Tan Sri was very supportive of me and the organization. But he never discounted the fact that there was other interference.
Well, I mean, you're kind of putting into that absence all kinds of speculation there, Brian. But coming back to the point about, say, something like Malaysia Airlines, Guna, where does the airline go now? I mean, you know, do you think that the story has ended in terms of this so-called experiment with foreign CEOs?
I think that has certainly ended. You know, Captain Izam has been more or less put as a... So what they might is perhaps get in somebody who has got experience in the airline industry and into the board, which I feel personally is too large already.
It's 14 people, right?
16, I think. 16 people. So... So then not someone who will be engaged in the day-to-day operations, but will oversee Malaysia Airlines operations. But as far as leaving is concerned, I think basically these CEOs are leaving for what they believe to be better opportunities, no less. And it's undeniable that they're using Malaysia Airlines as a stepping stone to this, you know. And they have actually damaged Malaysia Airlines in the process because... You know, that handover to locals, the transfer of expertise, it's too short to have taken place during this period of time.
Yeah, especially in terms of organizational culture, right? And that takes time to rejig or re-engineer. Well, we'll be back with more insights from Guna after this short break. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Brian Fernandez, and our guest on Pressing Matters this morning, P. Gunasegaram, an independent business analyst. We were talking about Malaysia Airlines, and if you want to join this conversation, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. In fact, we did get a message reflecting our conversation earlier there's no name attached to this WhatsApp message. Just say that this person believes that the board is incompetent and also says with regard out to Peter Bellew. Good riddance. No one is indispensable. They might not be indispensable, but as you put it, Gunnar, very rightly, it is damaging to the brand because it suggests a volatility in the management of the airline and a lack of faith in it.
Also
and
damaging to the turnaround plan. Yeah? That's the thing. Because you have so many interruptions. You know, there's no transfer which has, of expertise which has taken place. No significant transfer.
Right. This conversation is going to carry on for some time.
Yeah.
But perhaps the name of Peter Bellew will soon fade from memory.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, turning our attention to the GST, because we're in the aftermath of Budget 2018, a lot of discussions about how government spends money. But the other side of that coin is because how government make money and the revenue streams for government. GST, of course, is central to that. And there's a debate that was started in the run-up to the implementation of the GST. And since then, with the federal opposition, you know, steadfastly against it, saying they will repeal the GST.
Yeah, I think I'm quite against the repealing of GST, you know, because the one has to remember that the GST taxes consumption. So it's if you don't consume, you don't pay tax, you know. So it actually taxes people who can afford to spend, you know. And there has been a wide range of exemptions which have been given for essential stuff, mainly food, transport, and hospital services also, I believe, and so on.
It's like a very, very long list.
Because we, in fact, have the one of the most broad-based, zero-rated items in the world for GST. Yeah.
And the other thing to remember is that GST requires proper record keeping. So which means in order to claim the rebates when for your input cost, you need to show the figures. So this also helps to avoid tax evasion. So in fact, that could be one of the reasons why the government tax revenue is increasing because of the direct impact of GST and also the indirect effect of less tax evasion.
Gunnar, earlier this morning on the Breakfast Grill, there was a discussion about GST and the fact that we have so many zero-rated items on the list. The administrative cost of making something like a GST system complicated for whatever reason, protecting vested interests or you know, playing to a particular, you know, constituent, a political constituency, all that really adds cost to the GST system. Correct me if I'm wrong. Wouldn't it be simpler to just have a flat GST, and then you give back to those groups that may be under pressure from the increased cost?
I think in this case here, I think the situation was special. You didn't want to burden the low-income group, so you gave the exemptions. So now I think most, although it's complicated, it looks like it has been mostly sorted out. So if you go back now and you cancel GST, there's not going to be any kind of like price impact, especially for the more essential stuff. You know, your traders are not going to bring down your prices by 6% immediately. That doesn't happen in practice because for this...
Because the prices, they only ever go up.
Prices
they never come
are down. Always sticky downwards. Sticky downwards. Absolutely.
they're not subject to the laws of gravity.
And the price impact of the GST has already worked out through the system because GST was implemented on April 1st, 2015. Full year impact was 2016. So which means there is no more price impact of GST from 2017 onwards. Why are the prices of goods going up? Simple. One reason, one major reason is that the currency has depreciated very considerably. So this is what I think maybe, you know, the opposition should be talking about. Instead of, you know, abolishing the GST. The abolishment of GST will do nothing for prices.
Why does the Pakatan Harapan continue to put the removal of GST as one of the major platforms?
I think you need to blame the existing government for something. So cost of living has increased, and therefore GST is the fault. Yes, it's true in 2016 that happened, but it's no longer the case. GST has got no impact on prices anymore. It's the ringgit. So they are barking up the wrong tree. You know, this ringgit is what you should be hitting at. You know?
Yeah, in fact...
Why is the ringgit so weak?
Full agreement with Gunnar, because at the end of the day, the system has already... The key thing is the system has already absorbed the impact of the GST. We now have a broad-based tax. Governments around the world are looking to value-added taxes or goods and services taxes as a way to get broad-based revenue. So it's a system that's already... going to be working for us moving forward. The alternatives maybe, which is what the government has done, is reducing personal income tax to spur consumption and also to have a more spending power among, in this case, for example, the middle and lower income individuals.
Gunnar, you know, in your view, because there are GST systems all over the world, there are models to follow, maybe models not to follow. Where do you think we should be looking in terms of GST systems?
I think we were quite brave in terms of granting a whole list of exemptions, and as you mentioned, this could prove to have administrative nightmares. So while the GST system is complicated, it is working. Much of the problems have been ironed out. You know, so the thing is to make tax collection a bit more all encompassing. There are very few people who pay tax in Malaysia, you know, but we also know that there are a lot of people who earn a lot of money, but somehow or other, they manage to either tax avoid, which is legal, or tax evade, which is illegal. And so they are not caught within the tax net, although they earn a lot of money. So the GST is one way, because these people who have money will consume, is one way of recovering that tax revenue from them. In a sort of like a roundabout way. So it's a consumption tax. It's a value-added tax. And it also, taxes consumption. You know? So the more you spend, if you have money to buy a huge big house, you pay a 6% tax on that. You know?
In fact, one thread in the conversation that we had earlier on the Breakfast Grill was that the nature of work is changing, especially with the digital economy and the globalized nature of it. It's hard to capture those incomes and tax them, right? So that in fact, moving to a model where you tax consumption rather than incomes is the way to go. Do you agree?
Yes, I certainly think that's the way. But even then, you must remember that GST exemption is given for those smaller enterprises whose turnover is less than 500,000 a year. So if you are a freelancer, for instance, and if you earn less than 500,000 a year, or if you bill amounts of less than 500,000 a year, you don't have to pay GST on that. So there is actually a lot of already inbuilt things, and it'll be rather regressive to go back and just cancel off GST. More than 140 countries around the world have GST.
So Gunnar, do you think that by putting in their alternative budget that they're looking to repeal GST, the opposition has potentially shot itself in the foot?
I don't know, you know, maybe they have, but it is not very sound economically, you know. So if you want to reduce the burden on the lower income group even more, then you can zeroize more items, you know, the way it is done at the moment. You know? So there is a solution. You don't have to remove it altogether.
We have a tweet from Victor Liu. He says, I wish they would buck up on GST refunds. It's causing cash flow problems.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a number of people in business complain about that, you know, because as I mentioned just now, you can get your rebates from the input cost, you know, for your input cost. So that sometimes takes a lot of time, and also it's a bit too harsh in terms of implementation. The moment you invoice, they want you to pay the tax within 1 month, even though you have not collected your invoice
exactly.
yet. So that is terribly unreasonable.
In Malaysia, a lot of people, you know, they pay you in 60 days, 90 days. So essentially,
sometimes even longer than that.
Exactly. So essentially, you're paying the government first before you've received any revenues from that invoice.
Yeah. So this could be a question of tweaking the system.
Yes.
Government much more sensitive to the reality of how the GST works, especially as it impacts the business community, because we, you know, this government, if nothing else, says it's business friendly, and therefore the need to make sense of the realities in the ground.
Yeah.
What else would you say? I mean, in terms of low, in terms of tweaking, do you think we could look at in terms of ways to go for the government?
I think tweaking might be, it gets more complicated if you want to take, the more you tweak, the more complex it becomes. Then maybe more exemptions is one way. Maybe having different layers of tax, but which will become very complicated. And I don't think that is a real option.
Okay. We had other messages come through WhatsApp and people weighing on the mass issues, saying a foreign CEO upset a segment of the vote bank. wonderful conspiracy theories there. That's the Malaysian way, isn't it? Thank you so much, P. Gunasegaram, independent business analyst. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Brian Fernandez, and this has been Pressing Matters. We're coming up to the top of the hour, and then we'll be back with Enterprise. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.